Thank you. At this point, what I'd like to do is introduce Dr. Tom Cochran, who is our next speaker. And Tom is a senior scientist in the Natural Resources Defense Council nuclear program and holds the Wade Green Chair for Nuclear Policy at NRDC. And he served as the director of the nuclear program until 2007 and initiated NRDC's Nuclear Weapons Data Book Project. As well, Dr. Cochran has served on numerous government and private sector advisory committees on energy and nuclear nonproliferation. And proud to say that Dr. Cochran received his PhD in physics from Vanderbilt University. So, Dr. Cochran.
Well, it's a pleasure to speak at a symposium at Vanderbilt honoring Professor Frank Parker. And as mentioned, I was a student here for 9 years. I should have gotten tenure, but they didn't give tenure to students. The first four of those were in here in the engineering school. And it was interesting. I have fond memories. I woke up this morning and opened my blinds at the Lowe's Vanderbilt Hotel, and I looked out over what used to be the site of the fraternity I was kicked out of as a freshman. And directly across the street was the dormitory I was kicked out of as a sophomore. But after leaving the engineering school, I went to the physics department, and I had a health physics fellowship initially. And Dr. Carl Morgan and others from Oak Ridge used to drive over here and teach the course in health physics, and then we received our on-the-job summer training at Oak Ridge in 1963 and were cycled through the various laboratories, including Frank Parker's. But here at Vanderbilt and at Oak Ridge, I learned the basic tenet of the health physics profession that any exposure of radiation is assumed to entail a risk of deleterious effects to radiation, and the exposures should be kept as low as practicable. Now, the LARA. And of course, we were schooled in the methodologies for assessing risk and so forth. Almost a decade earlier, in 1955, the Atomic Energy Commission asked the National Academy to evaluate options for geologic disposal. And as was shown on the earlier slides, they released their report in first of many reports in 1957. And it's interesting to recall two of the statements, conclusions in this early report 50 years ago. The first and the one most often cited is the disposal in cavities mined in salt beds and salt domes is suggested as the possible promising and most practical immediate solution to the problem. But I think the more interesting admonition in that report is the following. Unlike the disposal of any other type of waste, the hazard related to radioactive waste is so great that no element of doubt should be allowed to exist regarding safety. Stringent rules must be set up and a system of inspection and monitoring instituted. Safe disposal means that waste shall not come in contact with any living thing. Now, this is the interesting, there's something in here for everybody. Considering the half-lives of the isotopes in waste, this means for 600 years, if cesium and strontium are present, or for about one-tenth that many years if the two isotopes are removed. Well, this might be marked as the beginning of several failed efforts by the federal government to solve this problem. The first being, of course, the efforts in Lyons, Kansas in the early 70s, where the AEC had announced that there would be a demonstration repository at the Cary Salt Mine, and that effort was defeated largely because of the efforts of the Kansas Geological Survey because of concerns over solution mining at an adjacent salt mine and the presence of oil and gas wells in the vicinity and other problems. And then, as you recall, Schlesinger announced in 1972, when he was chairman of the AEC, that we would build a 100-year surface retrievable storage facility, And this was viewed by EPA as not a solution, and so this effort was terminated ultimately by IRDA in 1975. The IRDA and DOE continued to look for various sites. And then in the Carter administration, and I remember John Deutsch, I think, was probably more responsible for this than anyone, decided he was going to solve this problem once and for all. So we launched the Carter administration, primarily DOE, launched the interagency review process. And, of course, many people in this room participated in that to find an overall solution. And that was a very successful effort, in my view, led to the Nuclear Waste Policy Act of 1982, where many of its recommendations were embodied in law. And it basically set up two processes, one for the DOE to go forward in a methodical site selection process, first looking at the best media in the country, and then selecting the best sites within that media, and then down selecting to a few sites and picking the best one. And on the other track, the EPA and the NRC were given authority for establishing regulations. You would think you would establish the regulations before you pick the site, and they had plenty of time to do so, but here, 25 years or more later, we still don't have the regulations, as Ward had indicated. In my view, both of these processes were corrupted, and it is why we're in this position we're in today. And I want to review that probably in historical fashion. The first thing I will do is throw out Frank's admonition that we not dwell on the history. Since we don't have a solution for this, we might as well dwell on the history. So in the site selection process, the first problem was that DOE figured that wouldn't it be expedient if some of these sites that they've looked at were on federal land, preferably on DOE land. And that led to the fact that one of the choices that continued as a favorite choice was a site vertically, directly under the B plant at the Hanford Reservation. Why was that site chosen? Not for the geology, but because the B plant was an old reprocessing plant, but then it was turned into a waste plant for removing the strontium and cesium from waste. So it was an operating waste facility at Hanford. And of course, Hanford was chosen in 1943 during the Manhattan Project for reasons that had nothing to do with the favorable geology for waste disposal. And then, of course, as we all know, the process went forward, and DOE, under the law, was directed to start looking for a second repository site, and it looked like that was going to be in Granite in the east, and people started looking at the cost of characterizing the first three sites for the first repository. And so the Senate, and particularly with the eastern senators ganging up in this great political process, unfettered by any science, we selected Yucca Mountain in what became known as the Screw Nevada Act. Subsequent to that, DOE still had on the books geologic criteria, acceptance criteria embodied in 10 CFR 960. But after Yucca was selected, the DOE, and then slowly the realization that the site had problems that were not realized when the site was selected. And even when the site was selected, I thought this looked like an attractive site. It was out in the desert, no population, no water, and so forth. But when it became apparent that that the site might not meet the site selection criteria. What did the Department of Energy do? They got rid of the site selection criteria instead of the site. And so that's the sort of history. Having first proposed defensible site selection, a site selection process based on meeting reasonable geologic criteria, the Yucca Mountain site was selected as a candidate because the government already owned the land adjacent to the Nevada test site, and it was selected as the sole site for political reasons. And finally, when it became clear that it might not meet the original siting criteria, the criteria were abandoned instead of the site. So now let's turn to the other track, the regulatory track for selecting the criteria for assessing whether Yucca Mountain is adequate. And as indicated, EPA was directed in 1982 to develop these criteria. And here it is, 25 years later, no criteria. Twice in 1985 and 2001, they issued final rules which were overturned by the courts. The first one in 85, was overturned in 87 because it was inconsistent with their separate responsibilities under the Safe Drinking Water Act, and the second time around, as we all know, because it didn't meet the, was inconsistent with the recommendations of the National Academy of Sciences. But the failure to develop adequate nuclear waste criteria does not lie solely with the EPA. President Carter decided that all federal regulations should be reviewed and approved by the White House before being issued by agencies under its purview. And this precedent has been followed by subsequent administrations, some of which appear to place a higher priority on protecting the industry rather than future generations. As a consequence, the White House Office of Management and Budget holds secret meetings and oversees secret interagency reviews of EPA's proposed criteria, permitting the OMB, DOE, the NRC, and the NRC to water down any EPA proposed criteria that might be difficult for Yucca Mountain to meet. Although EPA and NRC are supposed to be independent regulators, they have held secret meetings, as Ward indicated in his talk, with DOE on the formulation of EPA and NRC rules. This continues even today, as we await EPA's third final rule, which is being held up by interagency differences over the final language. What I hear is different from what Ward indicated, but he's in the room, so I assume he knows what's been going on. But in any case, these disputes are state secrets. We, as members of the public, are not permitted to see what the agencies are, positions taken by the agencies in these secret OMB meetings. Now, to step back, the impact on future generations is derived by computer modeling, because obviously we're not going to be there. And the current model that DOE is using is called the Total System Performance Assessment Simulation Program. We all know that it conducts a bunch of Monte Carlo runs, calculations of the radiation dose to a hypothetical individual at some boundary point, and does this over time, and then you can compare that to the dose limits that ostensibly EPA will give us. So there are three key parameters or assumptions related to the government's efforts to establish radiation protection standards tailored to Yucca Mountain. The first is, where is the potential exposure to be measured when one is doing the assessment of the whether the dosages are too high? Second, over what period of time are we going to set this standard? Is it 10,000 years or is it a million years? And third, what's an acceptable level of radiation exposure? And also important is how the government handles the uncertainties in the calculations. And so we can see the results of the government effort to date over the last 25 years in establishing these standards by tracking these three assumptions. And I want to take them on one at a time. And in our view, in my view, the EPA, actually the executive branch, has corrupted this process. The most glaring problem is the first, and if I could have the slide. Now, at the WIPP facility, where we bury transuranic waste in a geologic repository, the EPA and the NRC have a 5-kilometer control boundary, and the compliance is set at the control boundary. But when it came to Yucca Mountain, EPA gerrymandered the control boundary. Instead of taking its 5-kilometer or 3-mile precedent in the direction that the water flowed out of the Yucca Mountain, it extended the boundary south to the lower limits of the BLM and Nevada test site, are extended at 18 kilometers, 11 miles. What does that do? That allows one to dilute the waste coming out of Yucca Mountain in this cesspool area between 5 and 18 kilometers, dilute the waste before it's actually measured for compliance. And then, just to make it a little easier, instead of having a farmer drill a well and drink well water, the EPA allows for the dilution of the radioactive effluent with 3,000 acre feet of clean water before you meet the standard. So you've set right off the top two assumptions that have essentially, I think, will put in there to make it possible to license this facility. Now, to step back, there are several approaches one can take to licensing a geologic repository. In the case of the WIPP facility, the facility is designed because the waste is not as hot. It's transuranic waste. It's like uranium ore. The security of the repository relies solely on the geologic media and not on any engineered features of the canister or packaging or anything like that. A second approach would be to adopt a defense-in-depth approach similar to the way we used to way we license nuclear power plants. In the power plant case, first you set criteria to assure yourself that the reactor won't melt, and then as a backup, you arbitrarily assume in 10 CFR Part 100 that the reactor is going to undergo a full meltdown, and you set separate criteria for the containment, secondary containment building. So you could do the same thing, which is the approach I favored, which for the repository, of having criteria for the site, and the site geology of the site would be the primary containment barrier, similar to the way we do it at WIPP. But then you would set separate criteria for the canisters. So for looking at the geology, you might assume the canisters didn't exist, and you set some criteria for the geology, and then you go back and set separate criteria for the canisters for some period of years. And the third approach, and that's the approach adopted by the government with respect to Yucca Mountain, is not to have this defense in depth embodied in the regulations, But to have one dose limit and allow the canisters and the geology to fulfill the requirements of meeting the dose limit over whatever period of time you select. And that's similar to the approach that's currently in favor at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission of using PRA analysis for assessing the safety of nuclear reactors. So I think one of the fundamental mistakes we've made is removing this defense in depth and removing the geology as the primary barrier during the first few thousand years or first hundreds to thousands of years. EPA further weakened its standard once it set this make or break dose standard by requiring only that the mean dose of many Monte Carlo computer runs be less than the allowed limit. And by setting the standard in terms of the mean, you basically are relaxing the requirements for meeting the uncertain conditions that it might be, the dose might be much higher. And so, and thus we go back to the 1957 National Academy report. We see that this is the complete abandonment of the statement that the hazard related to radioactive waste is so great that no element of doubt should be allowed to exist in regarding safety. Now, as we all know, unfortunately for EPA, in 1992, Senator Bennett Johnson, strong supporter of the nuclear power industry, and who I believe, this may not be true, but I believe feared that EPA would adopt too strict a standard related to the release of carbon-14 from the repository, pushed through legislation requiring EPA's final rule to be consistent with the views of the Academy. And of course, the Academy had its own independent views, and then they were inconsistent, and it all went to court, as we know, and the court vacated the rule. NRDC was a party to that lawsuit. We had two issues. One was the gerrymandered standard, and the other was the time period. I thought this was the case that the judge should have ruled on. You know, we should have won on this case. We actually lost on this case, the court giving deference to the opinion of the agency, which is a longstanding approach taken by the courts. And so this is perfectly legal, this gerrymandered standard. Despite its flaws, it's in the eyes of the courts is legal. But they, as we know, said you got to run the calculations out beyond 10,000 years, which in my view, I mean, I share with many of the rest of you, and certainly Frank, that the view that this dosages in 200,000 years dose limits don't make a lot of sense. But in my view, what we should have done is establish separate dose limit criteria for the site in the early 10,000 year period, independent of the canister performance, so that to allow for uncertainties in engineering, construction, and operation, and so forth, we would rely primarily on the geology, which, after all, is what the Academy directed us to do in the 1950s. And of course, after the courts vacated the 10,000 years, EPA, in its following its precedent of trying to figure out how to keep this thing licensable, and I say EPA, I really mean the executive branch, because Ward's predecessors were all in the room writing these standards over at OMB before they came out the door. They've set up a proposed two-tiered system. One dose before 10,000 years, and a separate dose limit after 10,000 years. And the first thing they did that looks sort of suspect is in the post 10,000 year period, they said the median dose has to be below the standard instead of the mean dose. The median dose now being jacked up from 15 milligrams per year to 350 milligrams per year. So first we jacked the number up. Then we said then we say the median of all these Monte Carlo runs rather than the mean. The median is about a factor of 3 lower than the mean, so it really means a limit of 350 milligrams on the median is equivalent to 1 milligram per year, or 1 rim per year to median, a median of 350 milligrams per year standard is equivalent to a mean standard of 1 rim per year in this post 10,000 year period. Now, again, I agree, doesn't make a lot of sense to talk about dose limits 500,000 years in the future. But if you look at the National Academy's beer numbers, if you exposed a woman today without the exposure, a woman today has about a 37% chance of getting cancer and about an 18% chance of dying of cancer. We're all going to die of something, but that's your chance of dying of cancer. If a woman were exposed at 1 rim per year over her lifetime to today, her chances of getting cancer and dying of cancer would be increased by about 27%, each of those numbers. And you compare that with the EPA standard it applies today of, if your lifetime risk is 1 in a million from some agent or some operation, it's not worth regulating. But if it's the risk is greater than 1 in a million, EPA will try to regulate it to, so it's somewhere between 1 in 10,000 and 1 in a million risk of dying of cancer. So the differences are enormous. So it's a game. We're playing a game with these dose standards in the post 10,000 years. The players who are writing this standard include the Department of Energy. So if I were in the Department of Energy, I would feel confident I could meet the standards. After all, I'm sitting there writing them. So that's the second corruption in my view. Finally, let's get back to this. These Monte Carlo runs. The DOE contractors have developed this computer simulation program, the Total System Performance Assessment Simulation Program, to run the Monte Carlo runs to judge against the EPA standards. The program is so big that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission cannot run the program. No member of the public can run the program. Where the applicant is running the program and publishing the results of a program that one that the regulator and outside experts can neither run nor assess the parameters in the program. The NRC is left having to write, have its contractors write another version, a slimmed down version, so that they can know what questions to ask the applicant, meaning DOE, so that they can better judge whether they believe or don't believe the DOE results. So where does all this leave us? Well, we have a proposed geologic repository for spent fuel and high-level waste that was selected through a corrupted site selection process that cannot meet the original site selection criteria, that will be judged against the thoroughly corrupted licensing criteria developed in collusion with DOE, the licensee, and judged with the aid of a computer simulation model that cannot be independently checked or run by regulators or outside experts. This is a far removed from the tenets of health physics that I was taught here at Vanderbilt and at Oak Ridge 45 years ago. Thank you.